Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 23rd, 2019. Oil production in South Sudan's Unity State ramps up.
In Unity, the production is still very limited. It's around maybe 4,000 something. In Thomas House, we are producing something like 16 to 17,000. So around 2021 total at the moment. But of course, we have only opened up a small number of wells because of the power.
And South Sudanese in the diaspora condemn Netflix for misuse of their country's flag.
If you use people's flag, you need to talk to them to see whether you're offending them, because a flag is not just about leadership, it's not just about government, it's about people.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government says it has resumed oil production in former Unity State, where production was halted in 2013 when the fighting broke out. The head of the Petroleum Authority, which is under South Sudan's Ministry of Petroleum, says Toma and Unity oil fields are now producing about 20,000 barrels per day. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Awoh Daniel Chuang, Director General of the Petroleum Authority, says several oil fields in the former Unity State that were badly damaged during the four-year conflict will be repaired.
By the 31st of December 2018, also, we resumed the production in Unity Oil Fields, which is part of that same block, 114. And then currently, we are also working to resume the rest of the fields because we have five fields in that area. So now we can say that we have two fields that are already on stream, and the rest of the field, which is Manga, and then Nar, and then Al-Har, will be coming on board as well very soon.
Chuang says South Sudan began pumping an additional 15,000 to 20,000 barrels per day this week from its oil fields in former Unity State.
In Unity, the production is still very limited. It's around maybe 4,000 something. In Thomas House, we are producing something like 16 to 17,000. So around 2021 total at the moment. But because we have only opened up a small number of wells because of the power.
Chuang says when a new power generating plant opens in Juba, it will enable the government to increase oil production in the area to 60,000 barrels per day by the end of the year.
If we have enough power, then now we can open more. And when we open more, then of course we should be expecting more oil from Unity as well. And that's why we're expecting the production to increase.
Chuang says energy shortages, along with a limited capacity at Khartoum's oil refinery, affects the amount of crude oil being extracted from Block 5A, which is currently producing 4,000 barrels per day.
The crude oil quality that is being produced in Block 5A is quite limited in terms of production. And the fact that it is limited, not because it is technically limited, but it is being limited by Khartoum refinery, because Khartoum refinery does not accommodate quality of crude oil that is very heavy, because we are producing a very heavy crude oil from Tarjas, and that's why the limitation is quite obvious.
Chuang also says South Sudan loses a significant amount of crude during the extraction process. He says the government plans to utilize enhanced oil recovery technology designed to increase the oil recovery rate and production. India's Oil and Natural Gas Corporation, which is called ONGC Vindesh, Malaysia's Petronas, and China National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC, all have stakes in South Sudan's oil fields. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The popular video streaming service Netflix is under scrutiny after featuring South Sudan's flag in a recently released movie. SINBO reports the South Sudanese diaspora around the world quickly took to the social media to express their anger, while Netflix says it meant no harm.
The very first image that viewers see in Netflix's film Closer is an image of South Sudan's flag billowing in the wind. The first clip of the movie is a scene setter introducing viewers to the main character, an experienced bodyguard who thinks quickly and acts quicker to protect people around her. Two Western journalists are accompanied by Sam, the main character, played by Noomi Rapace, who is a professional bodyguard and terrorism expert. Their car is ambushed by armed men in a desert-like area, which set designers aim to depict as a warlike area. The men, who presumably wanted to kidnap the journalist and their bodyguard, are quickly taken down one by one by Sam. It's an action-packed scene that lasts only 4.5 minutes of the hour-and-a-half-long film. But that opening scene has dominated discussion and has sparked questions as to why South Sudan's flag was used.
If you use people's flag, you need to talk to them to see whether you're offending them, because a flag is not just about leadership. It's not just about government. It's about people.
That is South Sudan diaspora member Queer Garang speaking from Canada. South Sudanese native Malith, who lives and works in South Korea, says movie makers did not consider the fact that the flag is a lot more than a plot object to many observers around the world.
And people like myself who have a South Sudanese bracelet, looking at the movie, I cannot even go to New York City wearing anything to do with South Sudanese flag without looking around for being attacked or something like that. So the Netflix just started to mess up South Sudanese even more.
Garang agrees.
There are many people here in Canada, in Australia, in the U.S. who use that flag. And if that flag represents terrorism or, you know, mindless violence and is seen on the cause of people, those people can easily be associated with terrorism, because many people here are not critical of things. So this is one of the reasons why it makes me mad, because people can easily be victimized. If their cause is seen with that flag and people are not critical, they see the movie and then they think a movie reflects reality.
Netflix refused request for comment. Garang says he feels the media giant owes South Sudanese an explanation.
And I think people at Netflix should see that they have resources, you know, movie makers have resources. So what they should do is to put in resources into making research as to what is appropriate. Talk to the people.
The scene featuring South Sudan's flag was shot in Morocco in North Africa. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
The Carter Center in Atlanta says known cases of guinea worm disease in humans have diminished to just 28 worldwide, all in Chad, Angola, and South Sudan. By contrast, in 1986, when the NGO began to lead the global eradication program, there were an estimated 3.5 million cases reported in Africa and Asia. Still, in 2018, over 1,000 cases of guinea worm were detected in dogs, cats, and other animals. Adam Weiss directs the Carter Center's Global Eradication Program. He tells Adam Phillips the life cycle of guinea worm begins when people drink stagnant water containing worms.
Those eggs or larvae are consumed by a water flea, which is common in all stagnant water sources around the world. That's where the larva can develop and become infective. And if anybody consumes that water, they will then ingest the larvae that are at an infective stage. And 1 year later, they will become infected with guinea worm. So from the point of infection to the point of a worm emerging from your body is 1 year later. And it generally forms a small blister with a very strong burning sensation. And people want to soothe the area and may actually submerge their limb into the water to help cool down the infection.
Oh, I see. And then the blister bursts and the mature worm releases more eggs and ova into the water, perpetuating the cycle.
Correct.
So what can be done to get that guinea worm out before they seek relief in the water?
You can help to roll the worm as it's emerging. And this is a process that can take many weeks. The worm generally cannot be pulled out in one fell swoop, but over many days, weeks, you can gradually massage the area and slowly pull the worm out.
And there's no cure for guinea worm or some kind of a vaccine to prevent it?
There's no cure, there's no vaccine, but there are a number of interventions to try and interrupt the life cycle. There's a chemical that can be applied to water sources to help minimize the population of copepods, which is the intermediary host. There's also the distribution of cloth filters and pipe filters, which is a very low cost and very effective measure for filtering the water to remove the larvae and copepods from any water that you might drink.
And I know that very rigorous surveillance is key in the global eradication effort.
The surveillance system for guinea worm is the backbone of the eradication effort. There are village volunteers selected by their own community to identify guinea worm, and they're trained to treat people who have the disease. They're trained to provide behavior change messaging about how to prevent the disease and how to report it and document it as well.
And of course, there are systemic issues. I'm thinking of the UN Sustainable Development Goal number 7, clean water and sanitation.
Absolutely. If every person person in the world had access to safe potable water all day, every day, we wouldn't be talking about guinea worm disease.
It must be really heartbreaking to see some of these cases.
Yeah, every night I think about people that I helped support to pull worms out of who were in dire pain, and it's the type of pain that can make any grown man cry.
I understand that one of the challenges for people trying to eradicate this is that the cases that remain are the hardest to stamp out.
Absolutely. The end game of all eradication programs is known to be the most difficult. Smallpox eradication went through the same process. Polio eradication efforts are facing the same challenges. We're talking about the most marginalized people. They're often beyond the end of the road where there is a dearth of infrastructure. And so it is a challenge, but it can be done, and it is being done as we speak. In Ethiopia, in 2017, there were 15 human cases, and in 2018, there were zero human cases. In Mali, they have gone more than 3 years without a human case. And those are two major milestones that the global campaign is extremely proud of, and both the national programs in Ethiopia and Mali are equally proud of.
That was Adam Awis, director of Carter Center's Global Eradication Program in Atlanta. He was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips from Chad. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the influx of Nigerian refugees to Chad. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how is the birth of a child celebrated in your culture?
When we give birth in our culture, they simply take a baby somewhere there inside a house. They gather together as a family. They bring pots of milk. They slaughter goats. So they dance. That's how we easily celebrate.
I understand in a very simple way that when a baby boy is born, it is celebrated for the first 3 days with some local drinks, some local beverages, something of that kind.
They give them cows. Yeah, once you give birth to a baby, they give him or her cattle. So that's the way how they celebrate it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of Nigerian refugees are fleeing to Chad to escape a surge in violence in northern Nigeria's Borno state. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Fierce clashes between government forces and armed militants from the radical Islamic group Boko Haram erupted in late December in Borno State's Baga town near the Chadian border. The UN Refugee Agency reports an estimated 6,000 Nigerian refugees have fled for their lives over the past month, many paddling across Lake Chad to reach safety. The UNHCR says most of the new arrivals are women and children. Many describe their desperation to escape the violence after receiving threats of retaliation and intimidation following militant attacks. UNHCR spokesman Charlie Yaxley says Chadian authorities have asked his agency to move the refugees away from the border area because of security concerns. He tells VOA UNHCR staff so far has moved some 4,200 refugees to an existing camp some 45 kilometers away.
At the moment, we don't have any indications that the fighting has spilled out across the border, but as I mentioned, the fighting in Borno State remains extremely volatile, and as a precautionary measure, it was decided to bring them further inland in order to provide them with their needs and assure their safety.
Yaxley says the UNHCR is racing against time to provide shelter and other aid to those arriving. He says new arrivals are staying in shelters where they are receiving relief items, including blankets, mats, and mosquito nets, as well as hot meals. Last week, the government of Cameroon forcibly deported some 9,000 Nigerian refugees who had fled fighting in Borno State. Yaxley says the UNHCR is following up on their fate. He acknowledges, however, it is difficult to get good information about their whereabouts and condition since insecurity restricts access to the area. Boko Haram seeks to destroy Nigeria's secular state and establish an Islamic state under Sharia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A boat made entirely of plastic waste collected from Kenya's beaches will start its maiden voyage today to raise awareness about the tons of plastic being dumped in the Indian Ocean every year. The boat will sail from Lamu in Kenya to the Tanzanian island of Zanzibar, a 500-kilometer expedition. The crew will make stopovers at the coastal villages and towns to engage with communities about the threat of plastic waste to the oceans. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Dubbed Flip Floppy, the first of its kind boat, is made from 10 tons of discarded plastic. It has been built by a team calling for a plastic revolution to stem the flow of up to 12 million tons of plastic waste dumped into the world's ocean every year. Some of it merges into massive islands of debris. Dipesh Pabari is the co-founder of the project.
It's a small dhow. It's only 9 meters long. Tried and tested on the water around Lamu for the past 4 to 5 months. We launched the boat September 2018 on World Ocean Day. In terms of safety, the boat is equipped with life jackets, VHF radio. We actually have a company that is assisting us in terms of global risk management on the ocean. We have an accompanying dhow that is 12 meters long that has already sailed to Zanzibar. Will be accompanying us on it.
The sailing boat is expected to arrive in Zanzibar's Stone Town on February the 7th.
We'll be stopping along route, intending to stop in Watamu, Kilifi, Mombasa, Diani, and Shimoni before we make our way across the ocean into Tanzanian waters with the blessings of the Tanzanian authorities. It's not a new route. It's a route that has been plowed for the past 2,000 years, if not longer, by dhows trading alongside. We will also be hosting various talks, we'll be showing films. The idea is to pass on a positive message, a message of hope, a message of change.
In Africa, marine debris represents a potential threat to food security and economic development. With over 12 million people on the continent engaged in fisheries, their livelihood is directly affected by marine pollution. Joyce Msuya is the acting executive director at the Nairobi-based United Nations Environment.
Let's look at the facts. Why plastics? We are drowning in plastics. We recycle barely 9% of the plastic we use. Sub-Saharan Africa generates 170 million tons of waste annually, 12% of which is plastic, 12% of 170 million tons of waste. We just cannot afford to continue with business as usual.
The expedition comes a month before the United Nations Environment Assembly, the world's highest level decision-making body on the environment, meets in Nairobi. More than 150 environment ministers from around the world are expected to attend. Coletta Anita Mkulwana, South African High Commissioner to Kenya, representing the Africa Diplomatic Corps, says education is key to tackling the problem.
As we celebrate this innovative solution from our home ground, it is important that we deal with some of these challenges. Within no time in our oceans, we might have more plastic than fish itself. How do we respond to these challenges? We need to make sure that we don't leave people behind.
The Dow has partnered with the UN Environment's Clean Seas Campaign, which engages government, the public, and the private sector in the fight against marine plastic pollution. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The South Sudan government is once again calling on international donors to fund the implementation of the revitalized peace deal. South Sudan's Foreign Affairs Deputy Minister briefed foreign envoys in Juba today on progress made so far while admitting the country was way behind schedule. Wake Simon Wood reports for VOA from Juba.
Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister Deng Dao Deng says the government's failure to raise funds for the deal's implementation will have consequences, but did not elaborate.
Our specific appeal is for our partners and for the diplomatic community in Juba to give support, you know, to provide the gaps that are there so that we can now move and implement the provisions and particularly the established mechanism for the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement.
Last week, Jock Madud Jock, a policy analyst at the Juba-based Soot Institute, told South Sudan in Focus that rather than beg for funds from the international community, the South Sudan government should step up and use its own resources, including oil revenue, to implement the revised peace deal.
It is time that we stop crying for outside help and start doing things for ourselves with whatever little money we have so that a trust can be built between citizens and the state, between citizens and the ordinary citizens and the leaders. Time is now for all to show what they are made of. Time is not on our side to keep crying and calling for outsiders to come and solve the problems that we created.
Deng says the government has opened what he calls a seat account in which all funds for implementing the revised peace deal will be deposited. He says the government deposited 100 million South Sudanese pounds and $1 million into the account, which he says is being used to fund implementation of the deal. Deng says during recent trips to China, South Africa, and Egypt, President Salva Kiir has lobbied for donor funding to help implement the deal. He says South Africa pledged to donate 100 million rand, Japan vowed to put up another $100 million, and Egypt pledged to provide an unspecified amount, but Deng says more is needed.
If you don't have resources, you cannot move. It is availability of the resources that will actually enhance the process itself. Putting up the cantonment, you will require, transport, you will require the tents, you will require the food, you require the medicine, and then the clean drinking water. It definitely needs the money.
The government has yet to come up with a budget for implementing the entire peace agreement. Gotch Mokwach, South Sudan's Deputy Minister for Finance, says the 2018-2019 fiscal year budget approved by Parliament includes 3 billion South Sudanese pounds or about $20 million for implementing the peace deal. Deng says the National Pre-Transitional Committee, which is comprised of both government and opposition officials, have yet to announce a budget for implementing the deal. Deng acknowledges there is perception by outside countries and more than a few South Sudanese that the deal is not inclusive and cannot restore peace and stability across the country. He complains some envoys based in Juba have sent back critical reports to their governments about South Sudan's handling of the implementation process, which he says doesn't help.
I know you are still writing a lot of negative reports in our country. And the writing of negative report is what is killing this country. It is what is sanctioning people in this country. So if you don't have a correct report, this is a report I'm giving you.
Deng told the envoys that even though the former warring parties are behind schedule in implementing the deal, they are committed to seeing it through, but they cannot do it without donor support. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John, and nice to have you back.
Thank you.
South Sudan is pumping more oil in the former Unity State. Production was halted in 2013 when the conflict started. A wowed Danielle Chuang, the head of the Petroleum Authority, which is part of South Sudan's petroleum ministry, says the Toma and Unity oil fields will produce about 20,000 barrels a day. Chuang says several oil fields in the former Unity State that were badly damaged during the 4 years of fighting there will be repaired. He says South Sudan began pumping an additional 15,000 to 20,000 barrels per day this week from its former Unity State oil fields. Chuang says when a new power generating plant opens in Juba, the government will increase production in that area to 60,000 barrels a day by the end of the year. The popular video streaming service Netflix is under fire after displaying South Sudan's flag in a recent Netflix-made movie. The South Sudanese diaspora around the world took to social media quickly to express their anger, while Netflix has said it meant no harm. The first thing viewers see in the film Closer is an image of South Sudan's flag billowing in the wind. Two Western journalists are accompanied by Sam, the main character, who is a professional bodyguard and terrorism expert. Their car's ambushed by armed men in a desert-like setting, which is supposed to depict a warlike area. The men, who presumably wanted to kidnap the journalists and their bodyguard, are quickly taken down by the main character. It's an action-packed scene that lasts only 4.5 minutes, but the opening scene dominates online discussion and sparked questions as to why South Sudan's flag was even used. South Sudan diaspora member Queer Grang in Canada says if you use people's flag, you need to talk to them to see whether you are offending them, because it is not just about leadership, it is not just about government, it's about people. And finally, the Carter Center in Atlanta says known cases of guinea worm disease in human beings has been reduced to only 28 cases worldwide, all of them in Chad, Angola, and South Sudan. In 1986, when the NGO began to lead the global eradication program, there were some 3.5 million cases reported across Africa and Asia. Last year, over 1,000 cases of guinea worm were detected in dogs, cats, and other animals. Adam Weiss, who directs the Carter Center's global eradication program, says the life cycle of the guinea worm begins when people drink standing water that contains the tiny crustaceans that carry its larva. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Wednesday. But today is a sad day for music fans across Africa. Legendary Zimbabwean musician Oliver Mtukudzi, who has been singing for 4 decades, died at the age of 66, rather. Our condolences to the family. What shall we do? We have been listening to late Oliver Mtukudzi with that song, I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could join us. If you'd like to share a comment about this show, send us an email at voasouthsudan@voanews.com. If you're planning to be out of Juba where you cannot listen to us on any FM radio station, you can still find us on shortwave. Our frequencies are 11850 kilohertz. Na wanze ze, uminywa ne wa ukere na ye.